Okay, so I have two goals tonight if we have the time. Number one is to add in one extra point from the last week or two's discussion about light and darkness and Hanukkah and Kislev, etc. And then I want to focus on the Shevet of the month, which is Binyamin. So those are our two goals tonight, to figure out why Binyamin is the Shevet of the month and to add in one point from last week. So we've been discussing the past 2 weeks the idea of light and darkness and Kislev being the darkest month and the Chosh representing confusion and how the culture and the philosophy of Yavla and of Greece is the nation which provides darkness to this world, which kind of pulls the wool over our eyes and causes us to be confused. We discussed how Torah is our light, and Torah gives us clarity, and that's the light we're trying to bring out with Hanukkah. So I wanted to point out the one very important point about Hanukkah, which is the following. We know that the mitzvah of Hanukkah is lighting the menorah. And the menorah of Hanukkah is an extension of the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash. We know we light the menorah because of the nes which occurred in the Beis HaMikdash itself. So I want to try to understand, in light of everything we've discussed, I want to understand the concept of the menorah. Now we can really understand the menorah in a much deeper way. So obviously the menorah is light. You know, and when the choshech of Kislev sets in, and Yovan triumphs, so our job is to light the menorah and bring the light to the world. And that's a very simple connection to make. So we have a mitzvah every single year in Kislev that we light our menorah and we try to bring out that light physically to a dark world. But it goes much deeper than this. It's interesting that in the Hanukkah story, we find that all the oil was contaminated. It was all tameh besides that one jug of oil they found with the seal of the Kohen Gadol, which means that Yavan had something, it seems, against the oil. Like, they went out to contaminate all the oil, and they were against it. Because they understood, on a deeper concept, they understood that the light of the menorah is what's going to be, you know, counteract their culture and their philosophy. So on Hanukkah, we try to counteract that with the menorah. The menorah actually obviously stands for light, stands for clarity. But it's very clear from the menorah that it stands for something much deeper. The Chazal teach us in many different ways that in the Beis HaMikdash, you know, every single vessel represented something deeper than, it wasn't just like you had a Mizbeach, you had a menorah. They represent deeper concepts. So when you walk into the actual Heichal itself, there's three different Kelim there. You walk in and in the south you have the menorah. In the north was the Shulchan with the Lechem Panim, with the breads. And then in the middle was the Mizbeach for Ketores. It was the golden altar. So the Chazal teach us that the menorah represented wisdom. The Gemara says, "Harutza shiachkem yadrim." If you want to be wise, turn towards the south. Which is actually quoted in Hilchos Tefillah. When you daven, if you're davening for Chochma, you should angle yourself a little bit southwards. Even though you're davening east, you angle a little southwards for Chochma. On the other side, in the north is the Shulchan, which represents sustenance and food. So if you're davening for Parnassa, you go a little bit towards the north when you're davening, because you're looking for wealth and for Parnassa. Those are the two different angles in the Beis HaMikdash. When I was a kid growing up in Atlanta, they used to have this weekly newsletter called Torah from Dixie. And the blurb on Torah from Dixie was this quote: "He wants to be wise, should turn south." That was the that was the blurb. So the Harutz Shiachim Yadrim. But the menorah was in the south because the menorah represents wisdom, and therefore, when you want to gain wisdom, you turn towards the menorah because it's the wisdom. The Gemara says also, if you see oil in a dream, you should anticipate the light of Torah. The Gemara discusses different things we see in dreams and what they represent. So the Gemara tells us the oil represents the light of Torah itself. And if you look at the different Rishonim in the Chumash and Parshas Truma that describes all the Kelim, they speak about at length the symbolism of the menorah, which represents the wisdom and the light of Torah. So the menorah wasn't just a menorah, it was something that represents to us the wisdom of Torah to the world. And it would shine to the world. It was as if you picture it symbolically, from the Beis HaMikdash, the light of Torah shined out. It radiated outwards into the world. That's what it did. And it was kind of like the conduit through which Hashem gave Torah to the world was through the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash. Now we know in the Beis HaMikdash you had the Aron and you had the menorah, in addition to the other Kelim. Now the Aron we know represents Torah as well. It contained the Torah inside. The Luchos were inside the Aron. And the menorah also represents Torah. So you have to ask the question, if you have in the Beis HaMikdash these two vessels, and they both symbolize Torah, then what's the difference? You're not going to have it like an overlap. You know, in Hashem's Beis HaMikdash, everything has its role. So what's the difference between the Aron and the menorah? And it's pointed out, the Aron also, the letters Aleph, Resh, Vav, Nun, also spell Or. It's also light. Right? The Torah is light, menorah is light, Aron is light. The Rabbeinu Baal Turim points out that Aron is Oran Shel Yisrael. our own Oran. It's their light. It's the light of Klal Yisrael. It's our light. So we know that the Aron is also light. But there's two different types of light. There's the light of the Aron and the light of the menorah. Now we know the Aron didn't actually shine any light out. No, the menorah actually had light. There was fire on it. The Aron, even though it represents light, no, there was no light shining from it to our knowledge. And you have to contrast the two. So what I'm saying is really based, I think, on the Netziv's Perush and the Chumash. I embellish a little bit upon it. But essentially, the way you view these two different things, the Aron and the menorah, is that the Torah really has two different parts to it. On the one hand, the Torah is the eternal truth of Hashem, which is far beyond us, in a certain way, inaccessible, beyond our world, you know, locked up. And the Aron represents that. The Aron is something, it's behind closed doors. Nobody really walks into the room. No one goes into the Aron ever. It just sits there. And that represents that there's part of the Torah which is just infinite, it's beyond us, it's inaccessible to the human mind. It's just like far out there, far beyond. And that's the Aron. You could connect that with Torah Shebichsav in a certain sense, because Torah Shebichsav we mentioned in previous weeks, and in and of itself doesn't mean much to us. We have to have the interpretation of the Torah Shebaal Peh. Without the oral tradition, Torah Shebichsav for us is not applicable. It has everything locked inside in code, basically. It's like a lockbox, and there's a code to get in. But the Torah Shebichsav in and of itself doesn't show us much without having the code. So the Aron is locked up behind closed doors. Nobody goes in, nobody sees it, you don't open it up. It doesn't do anything, it just sits there. And that represents the part of the Torah which is, you know, kind of beyond the human being, carved in stone. It's nothing, literally, there's stone that's carved in there, you know, the luchos. And nothing changes about the Aron. But then outside the Aron, and the Torah describes it that it's opposite the paruchas. I mean, the menorah is situated to be opposite the paruchas, and you have the menorah. And the menorah represents our access to Torah. How do we understand Torah? How do we interpret Torah? How do we illuminate the world with our Torah? That's what the menorah represents. It's a different approach to Torah. It's that we take what's in the Aron, which is kind of beyond us, and the menorah gives us the ability to be able to shine beyond. It lets us access it, understand it, process it, and give it to the world. That's the human access to the Torah itself. And that's why the menorah enlightens us. The Aron just kind of sits there. We're not enlightened by the Aron. It's just kind of like, it's a relic, and it's very holy, and something that we look at with awe and reverence. The menorah actually gives us light. Literally gives us light, and symbolically gives us light. Gives us the light. That's our access to the Torah itself. That's the menorah. And the menorah is described to be opposite the Aron to show that it's kind of drawing its energy from the Aron, and then it shines out to the world. So some connect the Aron to Torah Shebichsav and the Menorah to Torah Shebaal Peh. That's the, yeah.
I just want to ask a quick question. So Yatkin, like to become smart, it means Dafka, the smartness of Torah. It doesn't mean Chochma, could be anything. In other words,
right.
We're tying it in that Yatkin, that someone who wants to become smart
should turn towards the Menorah.
We're only talking about Torah smart.
That's what I'm saying. There are other approaches to it also. There are some people point out the menorah, the seven different branches, represent the seven ancient types of chachma, which would include music and, I think, architecture and all sorts of other chachmas too.
Because when we talk about parnasa, we're talking about, like, an attribute or something that's not necessarily Torah-related.
Correct, yeah, correct.
So I always thought the chachma was, in other words, why doesn't it say harotze le, you know, to become... more Torah than.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, yeah.
Yachkim,
right, correct.
Because Chachma is this Chachma Sagayim also.
Right, you're 100% right. 100% okay. Right. I mean, I'm building off of more the idea that the Shemin represents the Mora Torah, the Gemara says.
Right.
And Ner Mitzvah Torah, or
right.
We have that pasuk as well. But the Rishonim that do learn that the Menorah's Chachma also presents the secular wisdom as well. The Rishonim that learn that way too. That's a good point. So if you look at the Aron as Torah Shebichsav, kind of the locked-in Torah that needs to be decoded, and the Menorah is the Torah Shebaal Peh, which is emanating outwards, so we can understand very much what the Netziv tells us. The Netziv says that when Moshe Rabbeinu had trouble understanding something, he would gaze at the Menorah. And gazing at the Menorah gave Moshe the ability to understand. So he would actually gaze at the Menorah's flames, whatever he would do, and that gave him the ability to understand Torah in ways he couldn't understand before. Because Menorah is that light of Torah shining out to the world and helping us access it. So the Greeks came and they seemed to attack the Menorah in particular. The Chanukah story revolves around it. The Chashmonaim seemed very, very adamant to get the Menorah lit once again. The oils were all Tameh. Because the menorah counteracts Yavan. Yavan has no problem with the Aron. The Aron is inaccessible. The Aron to them, I mean, the Aron wasn't there at the time, so this was also conceptual. The Segmas Mikdash, the Aron was already hidden away. But in concept, Yavan can tolerate the Aron because they say it's not relevant to us. If you want to believe in God, go right ahead. But don't let it impact your life. So you want to believe there's this thing called the Aron and there's Luchos, and you know, that's fine with us. That doesn't bother us. What bothers us, Yavan says, is your menorah. Because menorah represents how you're going to take that wisdom and apply it to your daily life. And Yavan thought that's ridiculous because it's not scientific and it doesn't make sense to us and you're dealing with supernatural things and mitzvos, and that we can't tolerate. That's what Yavan tells us. We can't tolerate that. So the Yavanim, they attacked Dafka, the menorah, and the oil, because they couldn't tolerate the light of Torah being in the world. The way that Chazal describe what Yavan did, they tell us that Yavan told us to say, they were supposed to declare, "Ein lehem chiluk b'elokeinu," so we have no portion in Hashem. I mean, they weren't denying Hashem. They were denying the fact that we can actually have a relationship to Hashem. That's what they were denying. So they didn't want a relationship. And the menorah is the way we relate to Torah. It's a very interesting thing. The menorah is a mitzvah we do at night. Both in the Beis Hamikdash itself, they lit it throughout the night. The actual halacha was to light it throughout the night. They would fill it with, it's interesting, looking at times of year, the shear of oil menorah was enough to burn over the longest night of the year, which is Tkufas Tevis, it's called, this time of year. That's the amount of oil that goes in the menorah, because you're trying to have it burn through the night. And for Hanukkah, we light our menorahs as well, because we're lighting up the darkness of this time of year. We're lighting up the darkness of the night with this light of Torah, the shine of Torah. So the mitzvah of Kislev, you want to talk about the primary mitzvah of Kislev, obviously it's the menorah of Hanukkah, it's the mitzvah of Kislev. It's the dark winter nights. It's the time where Yavan comes to threaten us with their culture and their darkness. And we try to take the aura of Torah and to counteract what Yavan stands for. That's our goal. Ramban says in Parshas Baaloscha, a very famous Ramban, that the menorah that we light on Hanukkah is actually a continuation of the menorah of the Beis Hamikdash. It's not just like a separate mitzvah, it's a symbolic of it, but the Ramban seems to imply that we're kind of continuing on that mitzvah itself. We're taking the light of the menorah of the Beis Hamikdash, and we're lighting it in our own lives. So that's the Yom Tov of Chanukah. We're able to take that same exact light of Torah, which emanated the whole world with the light of Torah, and we're able to use that to illuminate our lives in Chodesh Kislev. That's what we try to do. I mentioned, I think, before also, Chanukah is known, it's the only Yom Tov is totally Torah Shebaal Peh. Every Yom Tov has a source in Torah Shebichsav, including Purim as Megillas Esther. Chanukah is totally part of the oral tradition. And it fits very well because the menorah itself, we said, represents Torah Shebaal Peh, represents the fact that the human being is able to take Torah, process it, derive things from it, and then bring it outwards. So Chanukah is that Yom Tov, it's totally oral tradition, totally Torah Shebaal Peh. And the menorah is the symbol of that Yom Tov itself. It's our access to the truth. It's our access to the Torah. That's what Chanukah represents. Going back to the number 36 we mentioned a few weeks ago. So the menorah, we said, has 36 candles, which represents the 36 hours of the hidden light, or aganas, 36 sets of shas, because that's Torah Shebaal Peh. And that number 36 all comes together. And that's what we try to do this time of year. So if we're to sit back and try to think about, now, what do we contemplate during Chanukah? As I like to know, what do you think about? So one major contemplation for Chanukah would be this point, that we're trying to fight the darkness by perceiving the light of Torah. That's what we're trying to do. The Or HaGanuz is right there in our homes. We light the menorah, we stare at it. We're perceiving on some level the Or HaGanuz, this hidden light. And that's going to help us bring out to our lives, into the world, the light of Torah. That's our goal. We're trying to light up, you know, see things through the darkness of nature, and be able to see that there's an illuminating force in this world called Torah, which helps us see things much, much deeper. Gives us clarity and gives us energy and gives us life. So that's this final piece. So Chanukah really represents the whole concept of lighting up the world, and the menorah is the pinnacle of it. Because the menorah is just bringing out the Torah in a way which is accessible to us, understandable to us, and that's the force that we use to counteract the darkness and the confusion the world offers us, especially this time of year. So that's the idea of the menorah. Any questions on that, or also move on to the next point for the night? Okay, so we refer back to our charts. We're going to do it right now, but we had a shavit for every single month. So the shavit for the month of Kislev is Binyamin. Shavit Binyamin, according to the Arizal, shavit Binyamin. So the question we have to deal with is, what's the connection of Binyamin to Kislev? It's a very funny thing. Now, if you were to ask me, which obviously I don't determine these things, you might have said it's Shevet Levi, because the heroes of Hanukkah were Kohanim. So we thought, okay, maybe Levi should be connected to Kislev. But the Rizal says it was Binyamin. So we have to figure out a little bit about Binyamin. What is Binyamin all about, and how do they relate to the month of Kislev? So certainly there's a profound meaning in this. I mean, we're talking about words of the Arizal, and these are deep Kabbalistic concepts. But we have to be able to find, on our own level, some way to understand how Binyamin relates to Kislev. So I want to be able to try to bring out an idea which really sent another idea of Hanukkah, which is an essential idea of Hanukkah and Kislev, and show Binyamin relates to that idea. That's what I want to try to do. So Hanukkah, as we discussed, number one, it's a battle of dark and light. But in a much broader sense, we know that Hanukkah is the Yom Tif that we fight assimilation. That's really, you know, the essence of Hanukkah in a much broader way. It's not just, you know, confusion versus the clarity of Torah, but it's trying to be assimilated into external cultures. We know that the Greeks, their goal was not to kill us. The persecutions only came from the fact they want us to assimilate. And there's a very famous piece we can read together. Maybe you've heard it before. I'll pass it around. It's quoted in the Mishnah Berurah. It's actually from the Levush, who was an earlier halachic authority. It's a famous concept. I'm sure you may have heard this idea here and there, but it's always good to see it in black and white in the text. And the concept of Hanukkah being a yantif of assimilation and what the Greeks tried to do is very different than other yantifs. We know that if you look at certainly, you know, Pesach, Paro enslaved us, attempted to kill us. Paro wasn't trying to assimilate us into being Egyptian. He wanted to enslave and annihilate Klal Yisrael. Haman certainly wanted to eliminate us. So if you look over here, I marked it off. It's under the big bays in the left column. So this is the Mishnah Berurah, but he's really quoting from the Levush. He's addressing the question that the halacha tells us there's no mitzvah to have a suda on Hanukkah. We know every yontif has a suda. It's supposed to make a big festive celebration. We know even on Purim, one of the mitzvahs of the day is to make a suda. On Hanukkah, there's no mitzvah to have a suda. So the Rama tells us that, okay, there's a slight concept that's good to maybe increase, have a little nicer food, something. But no one says it's a mitzvah. There's no obligation, certainly. And, you know, you can have normal food on Hanukkah. Latkes are nice, and sugan yot are delicious, but there's no mitzvah in having any of that. So the Mishnah Berurah is quoting from the Levush to address the question, why is it that Purim, we have, one of the main parts of Purim is the Suda, and in Hanukkah there's no concept of having a Suda. So if you look where I put the brackets there, Venira, Atam, the reason is the following. The lo kavu kan l'simcha m'purim, there's no mitzvah of simcha in Hanukkah, like on Purim, simcha meaning the real celebration of food and drink. Ki b'purim haya gezeir l'hashmin l'hagros ha'gufos. On Purim, Haman's decree was to destroy and annihilate our bodies. He wanted us dead. Shu bitul mishtav simcha, which was trying to eliminate from us the ability to physically enjoy, to drink and to eat and to celebrate. It wasn't a fashos. He wasn't trying to affect our souls, to impact our souls, just our bodies. Shafilei miru dasam chas v'shom. Even if the Jews decided to become Persians at the time, if they said, Haman, okay, you know, we'll convert to your religion, Haman couldn't care less. Lo yimakabu, he won't accept them. He wanted them dead anyways. Very reminiscent of Hitler, yimach shemo. You know, he didn't want us to be Germans, he wanted us dead. And even the most secularized, distant Jew, if he'd had any Jewish lineage, Hitler would kill him too. Haman was the same thing. Haman said, I don't want you to be a Persian, I want you dead. So when Hashem saved us from Haman, so Hashem made part of the mitzvah, or Chazal made part of the mitzvah, that we should celebrate physically, because he tackles on our physical bodies, and therefore we should celebrate with our physical bodies as well. When it comes to Hanukkah, it was different. On Hanukkah, there was no decree to destroy us. The goal of the Greeks was to decree against us religiously, because they wanted us to assimilate and become Greek. Like we say in Alonisim, that their goal was to make us forget the Torah and to remove us from doing mitzvos. Had we only given in and decided to take on the Greek religion, become Hellenists, and to take on their philosophy, them mass and to pay them taxes, v'chosen lemunasam, and we would take on their faith, chas v'shalom, lohayim avach shmiyosu, they'd be happy with us. They would have left us alone. But Hashem gave us strength and we were victorious against the Greeks. Therefore, the Chazal, when they established Chanukah, they established it as a yontif where we try to praise Hashem through the soul, not through the body. Because the Greeks wanted us to hold back from serving Hashem, to deny Hashem, chas v'shalom, but because of Hashem's help, they could not carry out their plans, and we succeeded. We praise Hashem for being for us a God and not forsaking us. So the decree on Chanukah was against the soul, was against mitzvos, Torah observance, and therefore the celebration is a mitzvah of the not of the body, but of it's a mitzvah of the soul. We light the candles, and the fire is something which is very. And in our world, fire is kind of spiritual. You know, you can't touch it. It's kind of like it goes up. When it comes to Purim, the decree was against the body, so we celebrate through the body. So that's what he's explaining. A very famous concept. So the Greeks, their goal was to assimilate us. That was very clearly their goal. Had we just dropped our, you know, our matzahs and our tefillin and our tzitzis and our sifrei Torah and said, okay, we'll become Greeks, they would have been very happy with us. They would have backed off. No decrees, no persecutions. That would have been it. It was a clash of ideology. And they wanted us to assimilate. So therefore, when we celebrate Chanukah, we celebrate through the neshama, not through the guf. But that was the goal of Yavan. So Yavan to us was actually a very tempting empire. Now, the Greeks were, there was beauty, there was wisdom, there was culture. You know, the modern world we live in really extends from ancient Greek society. You know, the whole world changed at that point. When Alexander the Great made his conquest, and basically turned all of Europe, at least that part of Europe, you know, into the Greek Empire. So that was really the beginning of the modern Western culture. That's where it begins from. You know, Greco-Roman culture, as we research nowadays, they still have. That's where it all came from. And it led into Rome. And it attracted the Jews. It very much attracted us because, you know, we appreciate beauty, we appreciate wisdom, and they had it. So it wasn't like, you know, the other ancient pagan cultures weren't attractive to us because, you know, they were barbaric and they didn't appreciate wisdom in the same way and they were murderous. So that wasn't attractive to a Jew. But the Greek world attracted us very much. You know, we could very much get along with them. There's a very interesting halacha that the Mishnah says, you're not allowed to write a Sefer Torah in any language besides Hebrew or Greek. That's what it says. You can write it in Greek, a Sefer Torah. And it seems to be because, you know, the Greek culture, Greek wisdom, is very much in line with Torah in many ways because they appreciate a lot what we appreciate. It's not so different than us in certain aspects, not so different than us. The concept of the Nisyavnim, the Jews who became Hellenists, that was unique to the period of Chanukah. We don't find Jews who are called Misbavlim, that became Babylonians. We don't find Jews that are Misparsim, that became Persians. We find Jews that are called Nisyavnim. Because many Jews did assimilate, unfortunately. And they became very, very Greek in who they were, and in their beliefs, and in their dress, and in their culture. That was the wave of the times, and that's what happened to the Jews at the time. There was a mass assimilation at the time, you know, very similar to our time nowadays in America, unfortunately. You know, because, again, American culture is also very attractive to us. The Jews can appreciate what Americans appreciate. So also we have Jews becoming very American these days. But because of that, it was very unique in history that we had, at least in those times, this level of assimilation. It was never occurred to us before until the times of Yavan. But we have a guarantee from Hashem. And Hashem tells us, we'll never forget the Torah totally. We say, Netzach Yisrael Yishaker. And Hashem will be sure that the eternity of Klal Yisrael remains. Now, we're not going to totally assimilate. That's a guarantee from Hashem. No, that's for sure going to happen, that we will not assimilate. We will survive. The Torah will never be totally lost. There will always be a pocket of Jews who is loyal, devoted, religious, observant, keeping the Torah. So what you have in times of Nisyavnim as well, in the times of Yavan, you had a large majority of Jews becoming very, very Greek and assimilating. And you had a small pocket of Jews who remained devoted and loyal to Yiddishkeit. That's what you had. And what's interesting is that pocket of Jews is always that pocket who's able to rebuild Klal Yisrael. Anytime history where we've assimilated, you always have that small pocket of very strong, very devoted Jews who cling to Torah at all costs. And as times move on, you rebuild from that pocket of Jews. You look at modern day America, you go back 60, 70 years ago, and there are very few people who were Shomer Mitzvot and Shomer Torah. But many people held on very tight to Yiddishkeit. And Baruch Hashem, look around now, and observance of Torah is, you know, is flourishing. We've a long way to go. But that was rebuilt from those people who were so devoted and loyal during those difficult times that all of Klal Yisrael was able to rebuild from that group of people. So you have that also in the Hanukkah story. You have this group of Jews who didn't waver. You know, the Chashmonaim. You know, the family which were our heroes, Matisyahu's family. And they said the famous cry, Mi Lashem Elai. You know, who's going to stick with us? You know, because the Greeks came in and tried to get them to worship their gods and to take on their religion and take on their culture. And they said, no way, no how, we're fighting to the death. Mi Lashem Elai. Come with us and we're going to fight for Hashem. And they were the ones who were able to be sure that Yiddishkeit remained, the Torah remained, and the Klal Yisrael could carry it on. And they succeeded, Baruch Hashem. They succeeded, and at that point we were able to rededicate the Beis HaMikdash. And there was kind of a renaissance in a certain way of Jewish life during those years. So that's on the national level. This is a common story. This has happened in history many, many times. Our paradigm is the Hanukkah story. But throughout history, there have been many, many times where Jews have become assimilated, where other nations have come to try to mix us into their culture. But that pocket of strong, observant, committed Jews who clung to the Torah at all costs, they were the ones who were able to bring us through to the next stage and to rebuild Klal Yisrael. So I think it's very true on a national level, but you also find it on a much more personal level. And I think this is where I want to get more into understanding who Binyamin was. On an individual level, you know, all of us have our struggles at times. You know, we have our temptations. And you have Jews, unfortunately, that get drawn out into secular culture. You know, Jews that are assimilated. The majority of Jews, unfortunately, in America nowadays are assimilated Jews. And they're not observant. And they're very far from Yiddishkeit. And we have that. You have some Jews who are observant, but in certain areas they're distant from Yiddishkeit. You know, we can also get infected by the cultures around us. And we have that. You know, we're all impacted in some way by the surrounding culture. You know, Hashem gives us all a neshama and a guf. The guf, the body, wants this world, enjoys this world, wants to enjoy itself in Olam Hazeh. The neshama, all it wants to do is connect to Hashem. The neshama is something which is totally good, it's totally committed, and it just wants to cling to the emes, to the truth. When one follows the Yetzer Hara, when one follows, you know, the tides of the body, so what happens is that the impurity, the tumma from the outside world can infiltrate, and it can also impact how we feel our neshamas as well. You know, I think about this a lot, but very often we feel very distant in some ways from certain mitzvos, or from davening, or for a yontif, or a Shabbos. And we have to ask ourselves, why do we feel so distant? The neshama is never distant. The neshama always feels it. The problem is, do we feel our neshama? That's always the problem. Meaning that the more that we follow our body becomes stronger, it covers up the neshama, and therefore we become insensitive. It's like the neshama is there, and it's loving Shabbos, it's loving davening, but because our body has become so thick above the neshama, we can't feel the neshama. That's our problem sometimes. So there's Jews out there that could be very assimilated Jews, but they still have a neshama, it's still in there, and it still only wants, all wants to do is serve Hashem, it's all it wants to do. It wants to daven, it wants to learn, it wants to keep Shabbos, but unfortunately the body of these people is covering it up, and they just can't access the neshama. It's locked up in there, it's just deep down, and the influences from the outside world have infected the body to the point that it can't feel the neshama anymore. That's the challenge that they have. But we know that there's something that's referred to, many different ways to refer to it, whether it's the Pintel Yid. Whether it's, there's a certain part of the neshama, which no matter how many averas somebody does, how far a Jew becomes, that part never gets infected by the outside world. I think the Chidushi HaRim, he calls it, when we say in Shemar Esrei, we say the first bracha is Magin Avraham, the shield of Avraham. So he says that Avraham succeeded in his Avodas Hashem to create a shield around a certain part of our neshama, that therefore it's shielded, it can never be impacted by anything else. So as much as a person can do which is wrong and against the will of Hashem, there's a mugging, there's a shield around a certain part of the neshama which can never be touched. And that remains pure and connected and through it all. That's the he calls mugging of Ram. Again, some people call it a pintel yid. You can call it a lot of different ways you can call it. The Nefesh HaChaim, I didn't copy it, but I have it here. The Nefesh HaChaim, of Chaim Volodzhin. So he talks about, in a few different ways, very interesting, he talks about the concept of kares. Now, kares is looked at as one of the most severe onshim in the Torah. And kares means that the neshama is cut off from Hashem. So to us that sounds like, wow, you can do an Avera which is so terrible that you're cut off and you're not connected at all. But he says it's not true. He says that even when it comes to Kares, I mean, he's talking in very Kabbalistic terms, but he says even when it comes to Kares, you know, you're not cutting yourself off totally. Now he talks about there might be like 10 different levels connecting you to the next level of the Shemayim or something, so Kares might cut off 9 of them. But there's still a little thread hanging. The Pasuk says, you know, Yaakov chevel nachalaso, that Yaakov is considered the rope of Hashem. So rope, the picture, the, just the picture, picture the vision of a rope extending from Shemayim down to each and every one of us. So every mitzvah might be one of those little threads, and the more that a Jew does averos, they might be cutting away at the rope. But he says there's always a thread remaining. You can never cut the rope totally. No Jew is ever going to cut themselves off totally from Hashem. He says that even the word kares, which means to cut off, it doesn't really mean you're cutting yourself off. It means that you're causing an interruption, he says. That's a, he says it's a hafsaka. It's not hachrasa, it's hafsaka. So you're being interrupted from Hashem. But there's a concept, it's a pasuk in Sefer Shmuel, I believe, but it's used in the Kabbalah to mean a deeper thing. It says, Laval yidach imenu nidach. That Hashem is able to orchestrate things that nobody's ever pushed off eternally. Everybody has their connection to Hashem, and it remains there, and it remains strong, and even though they might cover it up with layers and layers and layers of other things, about Veros and everything else, the connection remains there. And Nefesh HaChayim, he's adamant in many, many ways that the Jew can never be totally cut off. He even says here, he says that even if a Jewish soul is meshuka b'taivos ros, totally enveloped in terrible, terrible taivos and passions and lusts, he says, even so, im kol ze yisad ratzon is baruch shemo, Hashem, he founded, he established the fact, la'los nafsha ma'ide b'chinas ruchel, that a person is able to use his mouth, is ruach, du vidui, du tshuva, and still remain connected. And he brings several examples of how a Jew never is totally connected. As bad as a person can be, there's always some connection remaining. And then he says that the neshama itself is never nifgam, and never is never wounded, never gets a flaw, never gets impacted, because its roots come from a world which is totally protected from any external impacts, any external forces coming in to contaminate it. And he goes on and on and on with this type of language, again, Kabbalistic terms. But he's very, very clear that it's that a Jew is never totally cut off. And he even says here, this is actually a footnote, but the footnote on the Sefer says that we know in Klal Yisrael, throughout many generations, we've had many, many difficulties and challenges. And this is something the Baal Tanya points out as well, that many, many Jews, even who live their lives very distant from Hashem and not observant, when it came down to, okay, it's the cross or death, they would die for Klal Yisrael. They would die for Al Kiddush Hashem. And remember the Tanya points out this concept in a more elaborate way, but he explains that, why is that? A person lives their life, Mechal Shabbos, they treif. When it comes down to it, they're not willing to give up Yiddishkeit. They'd rather die than bow down to the cross to give their religion. And that's because, the Baal Tanya describes, he describes here, it's because we have inside this part of our neshama, which no matter what we do, doesn't get impacted. And when we're put to the test, that comes out. And that part of the neshama is able to tell you that even though your whole life was lived not following Hashem, you're not willing to give it all up because you're a Jew. And deep down, you're a Jew, and that remains no matter what. That's the Baal Tanya describes. And even though we may say things or do things that show that we're not connected, that we are assimilated, that doesn't impact at all this pintel yid inside, this neshama inside, which cannot be contaminated and cannot in any way be impacted by the outside world. We know that a goy can become a ger and be a Jew, but a Jew can never leave. A Jew can never become a ger. That's the idea of Yisrael, b'shechat Yisrael. A Jew, even if he sins, is still Yisrael. And that doesn't change. So we're describing now there's part of us which remains like pure and pristine, untouched, uncontaminated. No matter what we do, it remains pure inside. So just like on a national level, we said there's a pocket of Jews who remain devoted and connected to Hashem, and they rebuild Klal Yisrael in times of assimilation. So in individuals also, we have that part of ourselves which remains pure and remains devoted. And no matter what we do, that has the ability to connect us back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So you take a Jew who's totally estranged, totally assimilated, in a way indistinguishable from being a goy. You know, many American Jews, unfortunately, you couldn't tell they were Jewish unless they told you that they were Jewish. They talk to you about bagels, you know they're Jewish. But besides that, you wouldn't know they were Jewish. But yet, inside there's this neshama, and that neshama can connect and rekindle itself to to connect with Hashem, you know, at any moment. And it's amazing that many Jews who do come back and do tshuva, it's not a long process for some. You know, it's just like a click. Like one day they have an experience and suddenly a boom. You know, they're back keeping Shabbos. You wonder, like, where did that come from exactly? And the answer is, well, there's an neshama inside. And no Jew loses that connection. And all I need to do is one time be able to express the neshama or feel the neshama, and suddenly, poof. No, they're back connected to Yiddishkeit once again. So that's the story of every single Jew. And we can rebuild ourselves from this little point within that stays pure. So that Jew that comes back to Yiddishkeit, who is very, very distant, is because they've become connected with that part of the neshama, which is there and pristine and uncontaminated. That's where it comes from. So we know that every Shevet has their unique role in Klal Yisrael. We discussed every Shevet has their own, you know, their own avoda, and you know, their own elements they contribute to Klal Yisrael. But also within ourselves, you know, even if we're primarily from one Shevet, we have in ourselves elements of all the Shvatim. You know, we all come from Yaakov Avinu. You know, we're all Klal Yisrael. So you might say I'm primarily a person who's from Shevet Yehuda, but it doesn't mean I don't have any elements within me from Binyamin or Dan or God. I mean, everything is going to be in every single Jew. So what's Binyamin's unique portion that he gives to every single Jew? So it's very interesting. You know, Binyamin is a Shevet. He was the youngest of all the Shvatim. He wasn't born until this week's Parsha. He wasn't born last week's Parsha. He's born by Yishlach. Everyone else is born by Yetze. He's very unique, Binyamin. He's Rachel's youngest child. Binyamin represents to us the pure, untainted, undefiled, uncontaminated, pristine part of Klal Yisrael. And what do I mean by that? So Binyamin was somebody who never had to deal with Lavan. You know, his grandfather, Lavan, we know was a Russia, a cheater, a liar. All the other children lived in Lavan's house. They were there when Lavan interacted with Yaakov, probably when he interacted with his kids. He kissed them. He gave them all kisses in the last week's Parsha. Binyamin didn't have to deal with that. Binyamin wasn't born at the time. He never had to interact with such a Russia called Lavan. The kiss from Lavan is very interesting. At the end of last week's Parsha, Lavan makes a big deal. You don't let me kiss my kids. You're leaving. You ran away in the middle of the night. You tricked me. I would have made you a big party if I knew you were leaving. And I wanted to kiss my grandchildren. So what was Lavan? Why was he so big kissing his grandchildren? Maybe he loved his grandchildren. I don't want to judge him too much. But on a deeper level, this is explained. Rav Pinkus in last week's Parsha explains a very interesting point. He says that Lavan obviously was a very, very big person in his own way. You know, he was in a certain sense, he was the father-in-law of Klal Yisrael. You know, Yaakov married his daughters, and we all come from Lavan. So Lavan was somebody who was a big, Hashem spoke to Lavan. He actually had a nevuah in last week's Parsha. Yet he was still a cheater and a liar and a Russia. So Lavan had in his mind certain, you know, we'll call them like diabolic schemes that he knew would impact Klal Yisrael for all eternity. Because he knew that there was something deeper happening over here. He knew that Yaakov was creating a Klal Yisrael. So Lavan said that I want to have an impact on the Jewish people. Now, Yaakov tried to make a clean cut. Yaakov said, I'm out of here. I'm not going to say goodbye to him. We're taking the kids and we're getting out of here right away. Lavan said, no, I want to make you a big party. I want to give you all kisses and hugs and send you off. Because Lavan wanted to leave his final impact on Klal Yisrael. Lavan wanted to leave, you know, his lying and cheating and good-for-nothing, rotten impact on Klal Yisrael. That's what he wanted to do. So the kisses that Lavan gave to his grandchildren, Rav Pinkus explained, were actually Lavan trying to, in a certain sense, like infiltrate into Klal Yisrael and leave us with a taste of Lavan, which he succeeded at doing. And Lavan is able to catch up with them at the end and give all the grandkids kisses, except Binyamin. Binyamin didn't get that kiss. So Binyamin was not infiltrated by Lavan's rishus, by Lavan's cheating, by Lavan's lying. All the other sons bowed down to Esav in the beginning of this week's Parsha, besides Binyamin. Binyamin wasn't born yet. So Esav, we know, is a symbol of rishus in this world. He's evil. And all the sons bowed down, and Binyamin's not around to bow down. Binyamin's the one son born in Eretz Yisrael. The rest were born in Paddan Aram, and Binyamin's born in Eretz Yisrael. And I guess even the stress even more, this is the most surprising of them all. What?
So he didn't sell Yosef.
He was right, exactly. He wasn't involved in Mechiras Yosef. That's a good point as well. Wasn't involved in Mechiras Yosef. That's actually pointed out by the... one of the Farshim points that out also. I forgot. Maybe it's the Nitziv. Someone points that out. So that's a good point. He wasn't involved in Mechiras Yosef. He was, you know, at home on his own. And the Gemara on Shabbos says something that's even more astounding. The Gemara tells us in Masechta Shabbos that Binyamin died without sin. He never sinned in his entire lifetime. That's the Gemara says. Gemara lists four people that died merely because there's death decreed in the world based on the sin of admiration, but not because of any sin they ever did. And one of them is Binyamin. So Binyamin never sinned in his entire life. So you talk about somebody who is untainted and unimpacted by any evil, no surrounding culture, no rishis, no not even a sin in his entire life, like superhuman. He was Binyamin. An incredible thing. He never interacted with evil. He never had to deal with evil. And it fits very much that the Kodesh HaKadoshim was situated in the portion of Binyamin in Eretz Yisrael. Because this room, which in terms of space, is the room in the world with the most Kedusha, unimpacted by anything of the outside world, that's Kodesh HaKadoshim. And that was situated in Binyamin's portion of Eretz Yisrael. It's very fascinating. If you look at a map, now, Yehuda and Binyamin kind of overlapped at the base of the Mikdash and Har HaBayis. And the Binyamin had the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and he had part of the Mizbeach, and part of the Mizbeach is Yehuda's. It's just, you find like the lines drawn right in the middle of the Mizbeach. It's a very strange thing. But Binyamin is given the base of the Mikdash, Kodesh HaKadoshim, is in Binyamin's portion. And it makes so much sense, because Binyamin was never ever impacted by evil. He was someone totally pure. So he gets the purest place in the world in his portion of Eretz Yisrael. So I'm going to pass out. This is just to look at the bracha given to Binyamin. One more handout for the day. The bracha given to Binyamin in Vazosa Bracha, Moshe Rabbeinu. The copies are kind of goofy because it came from Mikros Gedolos Chumash. So like you have the, it's kind of, it's a little hard to follow the copies, but we'll follow them. Because you have one with the Psukim, and then you have one that's totally Mefarshim, and another one, but we'll follow along. But just to point out, when Moshe Rabbeinu gave the brachas to the Shvatim, the end of his Zosa Bracha, so Binyamin gets a one Pasuk Bracha, a very short Bracha. The Bracha begins on the front page, Pasuk Yud Beis, Le Binyamin Amar, Moshe said to Binyamin, Yidid Hashem, he is the precious one of Hashem, Yishkon LaVetach Alav, he will reside forever in security upon him. We'll discuss what that means in a second. And then it says, we skip the last page, Chofet Alav Kol Hayom, he kind of like hovers above him all day, Vein Ksefav Shachein, and he dwells literally between his shoulders. So that's the literal transition of this pasuk. So what's the pasuk referring to? So if we look back for a second, Binyamin is called Yadid Hashem, the dear one of Hashem. And the reason for that, we can very much describe, like we've said, is because of Binyamin's status. He was so perfect, so pure. He was Hashem's beloved. But beyond that, I'm just trying to follow my copies myself over here. If you look at the, sorry to go back and forth, look at the back of that first page, the quote from the Sforno. On the bottom, it's in the kind of the right column in the middle. I underlined it. Why is it called Yadid Hashem? Like it says in the Gemara Masechah Shabbos, Shebinyamin meis b'itcho shel nachash. That Binyamin died merely because of a nachash, meaning merely because of the curse of Amarishon, but never because of a sin. He never sinned. His chir schus l'fam, so Moshe Rabbeinu mentioned Binyamin's chus. So he's called Yadid Hashem, the pure one, the dear one of Hashem, because he died only because of a result of Amarishon's sin, but not because of his own personal sin. Then it says, Yishkon levetach alav. He will dwell upon him in confidence forever. So what does that refer to? So of course we can look, and there's many far from discuss it. Let's look, I underlined over here, the Eben Ezra, bottom left of the first page. And Eben Ezra says, Bavur Binyamin shu yadid Hashem, because Binyamin is the beloved of Hashem, Yishkon Binyamin levetach al Hashem, Binyamin will dwell forever with confidence in Hashem, v'Hashem shochein bein. Now it's on the last page. Being safe of. And Hashem will dwell between the shoulders of Binyamin. Referring to the fact that the Beis HaMikdash is in the portion of Binyamin. Hashem dwells in the Beis HaMikdash, the Shechina, and that's in Binyamin's portion. And continue there. Chufif Alav, Ala Kavod, Shayadar, Yerushalayim. So Chufif Alav, he hovers upon him at all times. That refers to Hashem. The Kavod there means the Shechina. Shayadar, Yerushalayim, because he lived in Yerushalayim, Bechel Binyamin. Hashem Shechina dwells in Yerushalayim in Binyamin's portion. King Kosta, that's what it says. So Ezra points this out. Because Binyamin was somebody who was so pure, so untainted by evil, that gave Binyamin the schus that Hashem should dwell in his portion. And that's the, if you look at this one more place, look at the Unklus, Targum Unklus, left column on the first page. Le Binyamin Amar, this is in Aramaic, so be sure to translate those in Aramaic. Le Binyamin Amar, Moshe said to Binyamin, Rechima da Hashem, you are the beloved of Hashem. Yishrei l'rachsan alohi, yihimagin And then going to the last page. Alohi kol yoma. So he will, Hashem will dwell upon the Yamin, and he will guard Binyamin. Uva'arei tishrei shchinta, and the shchinta will dwell in Binyamin's land. So you can see that all the Mepharshim are stressing this point, that Binyamin was someone so pure, so holy, so untainted by evil, and therefore he merited the Bais HaMikdash in his portion. That's Binyamin. So with all this in mind, we can really understand how Binyamin relates to Chanukah. Now Chanukah, we said, is the Yom Tov which fights assimilation. And we know that assimilation occurs, unfortunately, but the way that we counteract it is always going to be on the national level through that pocket of Jews who remains totally devoted and uninfluenced, uninfiltrated by the outside forces. And on the individual level, a person is able to fight assimilation by finding within themselves that pure part of the neshama that was never ever contaminated, never ever impacted, and rebuild from that. So we know the Greeks came in and they were matame the Bais HaMikdash. They made it tame. They were trying to infiltrate it with their culture in a symbolic sense. You know, they're trying to bring the Tumim inside. The culture of Yavon infiltrated Klal Yisrael. People became Misyavden. They became Greeks. They became Hellenists. And we were assimilated people. This pure pack of Chashmonaim said, Mi Lashem Elai. We're not going to budge from our belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We're going to stick to our observance no matter what. And they have the battle cry, Mi Lashem Elai. And through that, they rebuilt Klal Yisrael. So what did they find? One jug of oil. And this is really an amazing point. One jug of oil. So that jug of oil, there was one jug of oil that wasn't contaminated. Right? This is the point we're making. There's just like symbolically in the person, there's this part of the Shema that's never contaminated. They went to the Bais HaMikdash, and the whole place was in ruins and wrecked and tameh. And they dig down, there's one jug of oil that's still pure, with the seal of the Kohen Gadol upon it. And from that, they're able to light the menorah. So it was only because something remained that wasn't contaminated, they were able to rebuild from that. That's where it comes from. And when you take, it's amazing, you know, one little spark can create, forest fires, but one little spark can do an incredible amount of damage, or give a incredible amount of light. You know, that one little jug of oil, it gave light far beyond that which they ever imagined, and they're able to bring back the light to Klal Yisrael from that one jug of oil, with a tremendous light. And the same thing in a Jew. No matter how far a Jew is from a Kodesh Baruch Hu, if they can find that little spark of the Neshama within, they can rekindle their entire Yiddishkeit. Everything about serving Hashem can rekindle from that. The part of Binyamin within us all is that pure part of the Neshama, which is never touched, never influenced by evil. And from that, we can rekindle incredible things. We can a Jew who so far can, in an instant, become so excited and so engaged in Avodas Hashem, because they've interacted with that one little part of the Neshama, which was never influenced by the evil. It's an amazing thing. The other symbolism of oil, we know oil doesn't mix with water. You mix it all up, the oil floats to the top. And Klal Yisrael is compared to oil, because we're never going to totally mix. You know, you try to mix us up, eventually we're going to float back to the top once again. And that's Binyamin. Now there's a phrase, I think, I don't know where it originated, I think the Bali Musar say it. You know, the ktsas mina or is docha harb mina choshech. A little bit of light could push away so much darkness. That's all you need, is a little bit of light. And the little spark of tahara within a person could push away so much that a person has dealt with in life. That one little spark can just shine once again and push everything away. This is the idea of Chanukah. Now, Chanukah is a yomtiv. It's the final message to the Jew in Golos. It's the last yomtiv that happened, you know, in history. It's the latest yomtiv in history. And it's the message Hashem left us for Golos. You're about to go into Golos for over 2,000 years. And the message you must take with you is the message of Chanukah. And that message is that if you know the key to survival is that there's going to be a part of yourself which remains connected, then that's going to help us maintain ourselves through Golos on a national level and on a personal level. That little spark can contain so much fire. And just going back to the last one phrase we quoted earlier. So the Greeks told us, they said, I mean, it's fascinating, the way the Midrash says it, we're not going to discuss the entire point, but the Medrash says that Yavon's compared to darkness, and they told Klal Yisrael, Kisvu lachem achilu kashor, al-keren ashor, write for yourselves on the horn of an ox, she'en lachem chil b'kei Yisrael, you have no portion in the God of Israel. So the Greeks told us, take the horn of an ox, and write on the horn of the ox, you have no portion in the God of Israel. So why the horn of the ox? That could be for a different time, that's not for tonight's discussion. But they said, write for yourself, you have a portion of the God of Israel. And our response to that is, no, we always have a portion of the God of Israel. There's a portion within us all that's always connected to Hashem. You can never, ever contaminate, never, ever remove. It's always connected to Kosh Baruch Hu. And that's the big message of Chanukah, which we have. So Chanukah, and to me, I always find this fascinating. the probably the most observed Yom Tov amongst assimilated Jews is Chanukah. They say Chanukah and Kippur, I think, and Pesach Seder are the most observed observances amongst non-religious Jews. But Chanukah, we know, is a major observance even non-religious Jews will observe. So we'll say it's the time of year. You know, it's the non-Jewish holiday season, so the Jews have to find their holiday as well, because they have to be able to, you know, in modern culture, Chanukah became famous, I think, because of that. But no coincidences, though. I mean, Hashem made it that Chanukah is in this season. Why is that? And I think it's very, very clear, because Chanukah is the Yom Tov which fights assimilation, and therefore, even the Jews on Chanukah come out of the woodwork. You know, someone you never knew was Jewish, he goes to the office holiday party, and he says, yeah, I celebrate Chanukah. That's what he tells everybody, because he's coming out now to say, I'm a Jew. Because Chanukah is like a magnet to that part of the neshama, which is so pure and so clean. That jug of oil which remains undefiled from the hands of the Greeks, Chanukah is where we find that within ourselves. That's the idea of Chanukah. So there's no coincidences here. You know, the fact this time of year, Chanukah is what helps us combat the non-Jewish holiday season of the times, is because Chanukah is the Yom Tov which is supposed to teach us not to assimilate. That's what Chanukah is all about. But really, it resonates in every single Jew. And everybody loves lighting the candles and watching them. There's nobody who doesn't perceive that beauty. Because that beauty is the beauty of, again, it's the beauty of the Or of Torah. But it's also the beauty of us being able to take the oil of the Beis HaMikdash and show that I have in me this purity. And that purity can shine forth so much if I give it a little bit of energy, a little bit of light. That's the idea of Chanukah. So just to recap, I guess. You know, Binyamin is the Shevet of Kislev. And Chanukah, we know, is the hallmark of Kislev. It's Chanukah. And the concept of Binyamin is that he's the most pure, undefiled, untainted of all the different Shvatim. And therefore, he's the one that represents the neshama within the Jew. It's able to be so pure and be able, if we were able to harness the neshama, we can fight anything that comes our way. And every single Jew, you know, as far as they are, can always find that chilk of the neshama, that part of the yid within inside, which is untainted, and they can always rebuild from that. And that's Binyamin in Klai Yisrael. Binyamin is that shevet that represents the purity of the neshama. Yeah.
One little geographical point, if we're thinking of the modern towns of Modi'in, Hashmonaim, all that, that's Nechlat Binyamin.
Interesting. I didn't even know that. Yeah. Interesting. Do we assume those are in the same place as the ancient Modi'in?
Yeah,
that's what we assume?
They say there's this kever of the Maccabim.
Yeah, okay.
In that area,
beautiful point. Excellent. No, perfect. Okay, great.